The two men and the sedated woman were ahead of me in line. Later, I'd learned 14 people were waiting to see the psychiatrist that day. An hour later, the psychiatrist still hadn't shown. Finally, I asked what was going to happen and found out there were no beds at that hospital, no beds at any of the closest four hospitals with psych wards in the Chicago area. I begged to be discharged and, with the permission of Dr. M and my mother agreeing to assume responsibility, was released on the condition I enter a PHP the following week. I was asking them to make an exception because the hospital was liable for me. That was the counterpart to the PHPs that resulted from deinstitutionalization. Two of the men, assuming they were admitted, might be transferred to the state hospital. The woman? Who knew? The man in restraints would likely be rerouted to the Cook County Jail. That night, I sat at my desk. I'd been released to a warm apartment and a loving mother and had access to care. What about the men and the woman in the emergency room? What had happened to them? Few understand the power of the semicolon. It's our most intimidating punctuation mark, one people either avoid or cling to, whether they know how to use it properly or not. It's an unnecessary punctuation mark, except in the case of a list with commas. To me, it demands a mastery of finality, the period, and continuity, the comma. That wasn't its original function. It's said to have first appeared in Venice in 1494 as a fusion of the comma and the colon. The printer and publisher Aldus Minutius, who also brought us the comma, created and commissioned it to offer readers and writers a way to pause longer than the comma but not end. It was born out of the Italian literati's zeal for experimentation and invention. Its rules weren't uniform. Like so many punctuation marks that European printers used during the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, its usage was left up to the individual. By the 19th century, it was no longer a typographical mark that indicated a pause or could be placed in a sentence for effect. Its rules became more rigid. It joined related clauses. Historian and philosopher Cecilia Watson writes that this arose out of a shift in the way grammar was thought of at the time. Grammar and punctuation were no longer left up to the individual. They had general principles. They could be categorized and classified. Perhaps ironically, in terms of mental illness diagnoses, this was the Kraepelin era, a time marked by the ordering and classification of mental disorders. That day in my room, I hadn't yet heard of Project Semicolon, an anti-suicide campaign that, in 2013, transformed the semicolon from a challenging-to-use punctuation mark into a symbol of strength. The organization that led the campaign traced the semicolon back to its original function, as a way to pause. The semicolon could help those in a moment of hopelessness pause instead of ending their lives. The organization's slogan read, "Your story isn't over." People tattooed semicolons on their wrists, backs, and chests in solidarity and posted photos of themselves on social media, where Project Semicolon gained a massive following. At the time, the organization's homepage told me, "A semicolon represents a sentence the author could have ended, but chose not to. The sentence is your life, and the author is you." Part 3. 12. Sick. It came as a shock. DSM diagnoses are invalid, unreliable, invented, not based in science, not medically sound? How could the 6 diagnoses I'd received, and all DSM diagnoses, be just words in a book? That would mean I should have put them in quotation marks, scare quotes. Scare quotes signify doubt, anorexia, OCD, ADHD, anxiety disorder, major depression, bipolar disorder. Scare quotes, sometimes called sneer or shudder quotes, tell the reader that the term inside the quotation marks should be taken with a healthy dose of skepticism. No one knows exactly how and when the practice of putting quotes around words to warn the reader against taking the word at face value started. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, the term scare quotes first appeared in print in 1956. The OED describes them as disassociating the user from the expression. The linguist David Crystal writes that scare quotes tell the reader that they can't take the words inside the quotation marks for granted, but must look for special meaning in the mind of the writer. Scare quotes could have saved me from believing in the diagnoses found in psychiatry's Bible as if they were the gospel truth. At the very least, those diagnoses should be in regular quotation marks. They're the written record of ideas discussed by the DSM's authors. Quotation marks show that someone is speaking. Most grammarians agree they evolved from the dipple, a typographical mark that looks like an arrowhead. They then transformed into double commas at the bottom of the line. By the 19th century, they appeared as the elevated, inverted double commas we know today, and were used to distinguish what one person, usually a fictional character, says from another. With them, things might have turned out differently. On my last day at my next PHP, which I ended up in after the previous suicidal episode, I walked down the hallway past the many therapists' offices. This PHP was different, more traditional, with lots and lots of therapy. The hallway was filled with the familiar whir of the white noise machines on the floor outside each office to prevent passersby from hearing what was being said in a session. The first activity that morning was skill. It was a lot like it sounds. A therapist or two would teach us a skill that would ostensibly help us function better. Many of the skills came from acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, yet another CBT-based treatment that told me to accept my emotions, observe my experiences objectively, be present, clarify my values, and set goals. In the room where skill was held, I joined the others on one of the soft couches arranged in a circle. No one spoke. The windows looked onto the opposite building, into offices, giving us a view into the world outside the PHP, a world of people typing and conferencing and collegially laughing. The two therapists facilitating that morning's session came in. Both were nice, but over the months I'd been there, they, like all the therapists, had remained standoffish, not even learning our names. They handed out a worksheet with a bullseye circle on it. My inner A student kicked in. As directed, I filled in each ring, deciding where in my life I was hitting the bullseye and where I was on the outer rim. After skill, I met with my therapist for my exit interview. Her office was tiny and softly lit. The one window looked onto a brick wall. She smiled when I entered. I sat in the faux fur chair opposite her desk. She was blonde and sunny and laughed a lot. I didn't just complain to her. She was the first therapist I had who acted primarily as a resource. She'd met with my mother, my sister, and me to help us map out an emergency plan for when, not if, I was in crisis. That PHP didn't have a psychiatrist on site, so I saw Dr. M for my medications, but only a couple of times during the 4 months I was there. She'd asked about my relationship with him and if I was getting the treatment I needed. I said, yes. She looked at me sidelong, obviously hearing the hesitation in my voice. We talked about my time in the program. It had been a luxury. Although I was still teaching while in it, my primary focus was the program. I learned and applied the skills. In group therapy sessions, I vaguely processed what I viewed as my troubling thoughts and emotions. And I took my meds. Not med, meds, plural, never singular. A cocktail of drugs. Polypharmacy is the official term. As part of the lingua franca of the PHP, meds were for those embedded in the mental health industrial complex, those on mood stabilizers and antipsychotics, those who cycled through hospitals and residential programs, referred to slangly as reses, and PHPs and IOPs. Meds implied chronic. Meds implied severe side effects, obesity, kidney failure, tremors, tardive dyskinesia, diabetes. Meds implied the drug had as good a chance of damaging the body as it did of healing the brain. On that final day in the PHP, I asked my therapist about my diagnosis. We worked together under the assumption that I had what my chart said I had, bipolar. I don't know what made me question it that day, truly I don't, but I wanted her opinion. Do you think I'm bipolar? She didn't respond for some time, looking at the ceiling, considering. Well, I'm not the one who decides your diagnosis, but you've never seemed to have the classic bipolar symptoms, I guess. I didn't ask what that meant. Instead, I told her about the lingering effects of the SSRI withdrawal. They hadn't gone away. There was still anxiety, confusion, irritability, insomnia, and crying jags. I don't know how else to stop them. What do you want to do? She asked. Go back on the Zoloft? She nodded. Do you feel like you can talk to Dr. M about that yourself? Sure, I said. Of course. When I reached the group therapy room, two other patients were there. They stared down at their phones. I took my usual spot on a couch in the corner. None of us spoke. I felt in my pocket for the feelings wheel handout we'd been given. Folded, creased, and wearing at the edges, the handout showed a drawing of a circle sliced into slim pie pieces, each with its own emotion: bored, sickened, worried, helpless, hesitant, affectionate, connected, curious, caring. At the start of each group session, we had to go around and say our names and how we were feeling. I was either fine or not fine, okay or not okay, good or not so good. But okay and not so good weren't specific enough for the facilitators. So I studied the wheel and its emotions, puzzled, frightened, safe, satisfied, and considered which pulsed inside me. Anger. Frustration. The others arrived, and the facilitator came in with his clipboard. We went through the usual, introducing ourselves, identifying our diagnoses, and saying how we felt. John, schizoaffective, a little confused. Emma, bulimia, anxiety disorder, bipolar 2, PTSD, sad. For the first time, it struck me, we labeled ourselves with our diagnoses. We spoke them aloud as if swearing allegiance. Sarah, I said, frustrated. If I'd known how unsubstantiated the DSM diagnoses are, I might never have been in that room. Even bits and pieces, such as how the DSM-3 was sold to the public as scientifically proven, or how it was marketed not only to psychiatrists and researchers, but also psychologists, social workers, insurance companies, government agencies, pharma, managed care facilities, medical students, school systems, disability agencies, courts, and the general public, who, for the most part, had no medical training. Or how it was a boon to the financially floundering American Psychiatric Association. The DSM-2 brought in $1.27 million, the DSM-3, $9.33 million, the DSM-3R, $16.65 million, and the DSM-4, $20 million. It's unclear as to how much the APA has earned off the DSM-5. I had no idea the later editions were created by task forces of psychiatrists, psychologists, and other healthcare professionals, and that although that might sound like a lot of learned opinions and expertise, it isn't. Just 28 people were on the DSM-5 task force. To be fair, each member headed a work group of 8 to 15 others drawn from, according to the APA, a diverse group of professionals and consulted with outside advisors. Or that the task force and work groups argued about each diagnosis based on theories when they didn't have data, which was most of the time. Or that DSM diagnoses like social anxiety disorder pathologized the shy and oppositional defiant disorder stigmatized children of color like Darnell. Or that the DSM authors seemed hell-bent on pathologizing normal activities by giving them labels like internet addiction disorder. If only I'd been aware of the finer criteria and its role in the making of the DSM-3. The finer criteria was a paper published by a group of research-oriented psychiatrists at Washington University in 1972. It re-envisioned 16 mental illnesses in terms of checklists of symptoms. These are often referred to as criteria sets, and the practice of relying on them, descriptive diagnosis. Essentially, the paper tried to create a medical model of mental illness. Spitzer based the DSM-3 on the finer criteria, which would have been fine except for at least three major stumbling blocks. First, the finer criteria defined only 16 diagnoses. The DSM-3 had ballooned to more than 200. Second, the finer criteria was based on little empirical data, which means none of its diagnoses were valid either. Third, it was meant for research purposes only, not for a psychiatrist diagnosing a patient in her office. Still, Spitzer was determined. A finer criteria-inspired DSM-3 would show that diagnoses based on symptom lists were medically sound and scientifically valid. it didn't. Essentially, the DSM-3 reclustered symptoms, lowered thresholds, and presented divvied up and invented diagnoses as if doing so somehow made the manual scientific. Spitzer insisted that the DSM-3's diagnoses were, despite evidence to the contrary, sound. One argument he made was that they were more reliable than the DSM-2's, which wasn't saying much given the DSM-2's were appallingly poor. He also cited the field trials that were conducted, even though they weren't used to draft the DSM-3. The DSM-3 served as the foundation for all DSMs to follow. The DSMs 3R and 4 maintained the pretense that the manual was a work of science. Workgroups were formed. The literature was reviewed. Data sets were analyzed. Field trials were conducted. And 155 new diagnoses were added. The DSM-5 professed to be even more scientific than the previous editions. It rebranded with the Arabic 5 instead of the Roman numeral V to signal a new approach that distinguished it from previous editions, and said to the public, yes, this time, these diagnoses are scientific for sure, even though they weren't. Task forces and expensive field trials were set up to establish validity and reliability of the new disorders it planned to introduce. Alan Francis blasted them for asking the wrong question in the wrong way, in the wrong settings, and with an unrealistic timeline, and said the results were impossible to interpret. This seemed not to matter. Diagnoses were changed, and another 158 new diagnoses were added. Everyday behaviors like childhood temper tantrums, disruptive mood regulation disorder, mood changes before menstruation, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, and overeating, binge eating disorder, which states that anyone who has binged and felt bad about it once a week for the past 3 months is pathological, became mental illnesses. As Paula Kaplan, a psychologist and member of two DSM-4 workgroups, says, the DSM has little more than a veneer of science. She writes, the DSM authors diverge from responsible scientific practice by designing and conducting studies in sloppy ways, by distorting their findings to make them look better than they are, and by not revealing some of their findings or revealing them too late. Maybe, if I knew that the DSM authors and supporters try and fail to justify the DSM by saying that although its diagnoses aren't valid, they're reliable, even though they're not, and that's all that matters, I wouldn't have been so quick to believe the diagnoses I'd been given. After all, agreement doesn't make something true. Kaplan makes the analogy that we could all stand in a field and agree that a horse is a unicorn, but that doesn't mean we've all seen a unicorn. Another example, just because medieval doctors agreed on who they deemed witches, that didn't make those women witches. Peter Trier, professor of psychiatry and editor of the British Journal of Psychiatry, offers the example of ADHD. In studies, given the DSM-5's vague and extensive symptom list for ADHD, it would be easy enough to train those conducting the study, known as raters, to find high degrees of reliability. Trier writes, it is very important to realize that reliability in itself does not mean a disorder is better described or more valid in actually measuring what it purports to measure. If only I'd been told how symptoms overlap. Someone with depression can feel anxious. Someone with anxiety can experience severe depression, which would be fine. Both people with the flu and meningitis can have a fever if those with the same symptoms were diagnosed with the same disorder and those with the same diagnosis shared the same symptoms, which they don't. No zone of rarity, a clear marker between normal and abnormal, exists. I might not have been in that room if I'd heard about the homosexuality controversy. Homosexuality was included in the DSM until the DSM-3 in 1980. Its removal was a well-deserved triumph for gay rights activists that resulted from political and social pressure placed on the APA. In some ways, this brought DSM diagnoses into question. If the APA would, for the most part, erase a diagnosis from its pages for any reason other than scientific discovery, how many other diagnoses were equally unfounded? If I'd been educated about the DSM and its role in how we think and talk about mental illness, about its lowered thresholds and added diagnoses and manipulated punctuation and words that allow as many people as possible to be diagnosed regardless of whether they really have the disorder, about how its diagnoses aren't as reliable as psychiatrists want us to think and not at all scientifically sound and certainly not chronic, I wouldn't have wanted to end my life. The primary color of Dr. M's new office was still gray. It had windows, large windows. The view was of Trump Tower. Gone was the old swallowing couch. In its place was a stiff gray one. He'd increased the distance between his chair and the patient couch by about 10 feet. He wanted to talk about my time in the PHP, so we did. Soon we were talking about my future and the prospect of me going on disability. Given my dire prognosis, things could possibly come to the point when I could no longer teach, maybe not even write. Light reflected off the glassy surface of Trump Tower, causing the sun to glint in my eye. I don't want to talk about this anymore. His face twitched. Okay, what would you like to talk about? I wanted to talk about my upcoming move. The apartment I'd found was in the rear of the building, away from the street. Without taking into account how small it was and the absence of any view, I'd signed the lease and arranged for a moving company. Dr. M was surprised. That was fast. It's necessary. This was true. My mother was starting to be weighed down from the strain of caring for me. She didn't say as much. She didn't have to. It was obvious in her wan, drawn face. I also felt the need to be in my own apartment. He touched his well-coiffed hair and raised his eyebrows knowingly. I waited until the end of our session to say that I wanted to go back on the SSRI. He said he didn't think that was the best idea. I could, if I really wanted to, but I should at least try to give the other medications a chance. The discussion ended there. My chest tightened as I walked out of his office and down the carpeted hall, muttering, "He just loves the sound of his own voice." Our sessions became passive-aggressive battles. Most were spent in tortuous discussions about the dynamics in our relationship. I said I needed a doctor, not a relationship. He touched his gelled hair and raised his eyebrows. Dr. M was a Freudian. Freud of the Oedipus complex and penis envy. Freud, who attributed so much to sex and for whom psychoanalysis wasn't a way to cure or help, but to probe, pun intended. Freud, who believed that even analysis was an erotic relationship and had his daughter Anna discuss her masturbation fantasies with him. Freud, who was convinced that dysmenorrhea in women was caused by masturbation and that sexual organs were connected to the nose. His 30-year-old patient Emma Eckstein almost died from a hemorrhage after he authorized a nasal operation to relieve her dysmenorrhea. Freud, who called the sexual life of women a dark continent and thought only men were moral because they weren't castrated. Freud, whose many claims seem to have been picked from the sky. As Todd Dufresne wrote, arguably, no other notable figure in history was so fantastically wrong about nearly every important thing he had to say. Freud, who was also intolerant of dissent from those who didn't accept his theories, like Carl Jung and Alfred Adler. Freud, who saw himself as a scientist, though he extrapolated data based on a very small sample of patients, or an N of one, himself. Freud, who lied about the effectiveness of his talk therapy cases and treated his own depression not with the talking cure, but with cocaine. Dr. M didn't approve of Freud in every respect. Neo-Freudians, including Freud's daughter, Anna, have tried to redeem Freud's less ridiculous theories, though that's slim pickings, by acknowledging his shortcomings, which is a nice way of referring to them. Dr. M was Freudian in the sense that he believed the analyst had a special ability to discern in the patient what she couldn't know about herself without his assistance. My motives and feelings were hidden to me, requiring me to seek his help. Our sessions weren't a dialogue. They were built on a power structure, and he had all the power. I talked, he listened, and in listening, he learned what I'd subjugated to my subconscious. He knew best. The ironically named Self-1 scale measures how much you identify with having a mental illness. It was meant to assist those who may need help but don't pursue it because of stigma, socioeconomic factors, or prior treatment experiences. In studies, it performs well, but it doesn't test for mental illness. It gauges if a person suspects mental illness could be a possibility. The Self-1 consists of 5 statements to which you indicate your level of agreement. Don't agree at all. Don't agree, undecided, agree, agree completely. The first statement is too vague to be helpful. Current issues I am facing could be the first signs of a mental illness. What type of issue, and how are issues signs of mental illness? The second is unclear, The thought of myself having a mental illness seems doubtful to me. Is the thought or the mental illness doubtful? The third is puzzling. I could be the type of person that is likely to have a mental illness. What type of person is that? The fourth is practical. I see myself as a person that is mentally healthy and emotionally stable. The final is really two statements separated by one of the most common punctuation errors, a comma splice. I am mentally stable, comma, I do not have a mental health problem. The comma should be a period. The two thoughts are separate. The two together beg so many questions. What's a mental health problem? Is it a DSM diagnosis? A Freudian neurosis? Emotional discomfort? What makes a person mentally stable or unstable? Does having a mental health problem mean a person isn't mentally stable? Does a mentally unstable person necessarily have a mental health problem? At one time, I would have answered, agree completely to the first and third statements, and don't agree at all to the last two. I wouldn't have hesitated. Trump Tower was clouded by an early winter snow. I sat on the stiff couch. Dr. M sat across from me. The bottle of LaCroix sat on his desk, essenced, flavored, fake. I told him I wanted to see someone else for therapy. It seemed like the perfect solution, see him for my meds and find someone I could talk to. He touched his well-gelled blonde hair in a way that said that if I wasn't going to stay in my place, at least it would. He said I had to see him for both therapy and psychiatry. Is that your policy? I asked. No. He said, someone with your diagnosis needs special care. Bipolar 1? Bipolar 1 with mixed features. I didn't ask what that meant. Instead, I said we should take a break. He said this wasn't the right time, seeing as I'd just been discharged from a partial hospitalization program. I stared out the window. Snowflakes swirled in the air. I said I needed to see someone new. He shrugged. And with the movement of his shoulder, it was as though I'd fallen off a cliff. I pictured my pillbox at home and the nearly empty prescription bottle. Standing, I put on my coat. I'm low on my medications. I'll need refills. He said I should see my primary care physician. She'd retired a month earlier. I don't have one right now. He said this was my decision. Psychiatrist-less, physician-less. Out of refills and running low on medication, I left his office. It's hard to explain how impossible it seemed for me to find a new primary care physician, let alone a new psychiatrist. The withdrawal would start again, this time from all my meds all at once. It would be ferocious, making nausea and brain zaps and shivering seem enjoyable. As I stepped onto the elevator, I realized what I'd done. What if Dr. M refused to see me again? What if he cut me off? I thought of going back and apologizing. Once home, I sat at my desk in the blue tint of my computer screen and scrolled through page after internet page of doctor profiles. Rating sites like ZocDoc proved unhelpful in the extreme. What did top in the top psychiatrists near me list mean? What assessment was used to give a psychiatrist a 4.54-star rating? What did one star represent to the patients rating them? I made a list of three potential psychiatrists and called, making appointments with all of them. The first psychiatrist's office broke with tradition. It was the size of three offices. The yellow walls should have been cheerier than they were. A desk stood in the corner. Most of the space was taken up by a large conference table and six chairs. We sat across from each other widthwise, which made it feel like a business meeting. He was tall and wore a suit. His face was fleshy and the skin on his cheeks hung down, reminding me of a basset hound. I barely remember the questions he asked because he seemed so depressed. If I hadn't been so worried and desperate, I'd have tried to cheer him up. At the end of our session, he agreed I was bipolar and said he wanted to increase the antipsychotic. The second psychiatrist was thin with dark hair. I remember little about our appointment, except that he was my height. He must have agreed with the bipolar diagnosis. And I must not have liked him because I never considered seeing him again. My last hope was a woman in her 60s whose chubby face made her seem youthful. In a shift that seemed to reverse our roles, she sat on the couch and I in the chair across from her. It made me feel at ease and in control. As she asked me questions and seemed to listen attentively when I answered, the soft white light of a floor lamp shone down on me. She was the one. She might even be able to refill my prescriptions that night. At the end of the session, she said she agreed with the bipolar diagnosis. Fine, I thought. Fine. I explained that I was almost out of my medications. She suggested I switch to an antipsychotic. The particular antipsychotic she mentioned had some of the worst side effects of any other on the market. Weight gain of sometimes 100 pounds, vomiting that never goes away, a platelet count that makes it hard for your blood to clot, tremors. It wasn't that she and I couldn't have discussed it, but it didn't bode well if that was her go-to med. I had less than a handful of pills left. My sister got a referral from a friend. Dr. R squeezed me in for an appointment. His office was on the 22nd floor of an office building on the Magnificent Mile. The waiting room was nearly full of clients, a young man scrolling on his phone, a middle-aged woman talking on hers, an older man with glasses reading Vanity Fair. When my name was called, I looked up to see a middle-aged man wearing a white button-down shirt and suit pants that had a sheen. He shook my hand and introduced himself. In his late 40s, maybe early 50s, he was one of those men who oozed success and intelligence. I followed him down the hallway. His loafers looked too expensive to sully by walking in them. His office had floor-to-ceiling windows that looked onto Michigan Avenue. The affluent view said that he was either very good at his job or at making money. The pedestrians on the street below looked like toy figures. "Coffee?" he asked, pointing a finger in my direction. "Water?" I said I was fine, though I was thirsty. I just needed my prescriptions filled. He directed me to sit in one of two plush leather armchairs that faced each other. Without a notepad or pen, he asked me questions. In response to my answers, which he nodded, bouncy and affirming, as if to say, "I'm with you. Heard it before. Got it." He seemed to have already decided everything about me. When I told him about the suicidal episodes, he nodded, his chin jutting out. "Yep, heard it before. Got it." I told him about the SSRI withdrawal and the akathisia. He asked about the timing of my suicidal episodes. I asked if they were related. He nodded ambiguously. "Could be." The 30 minutes went fast. He stood and walked toward his glass-top desk. "How are you on your meds?" I told him I needed refills. He opened his laptop and renewed my prescriptions. "We'll clean up the mess of meds you're on soon enough. When can you come in again?" It was presumptuous of him to assume I wanted to see him again. I asked about my diagnosis. He leaned back, nodded his bouncy nod, shrugged, and said, "I don't know."
"What?"
He smiled a strange, satisfied smile. "I don't know." We scheduled my next appointment. I walked down the hallway and rode the elevator to the lobby and walked out into the cold onto Chicago Avenue. My mind seemed to open. I don't know. If he didn't know, none of them had known. They'd just said. I turned into the cold wind whipping off the lake and felt strong against it. Not long after, I sat in my office opposite one of my students. Her blonde hair was plaited. She was falling behind in my literature course, which was required for her major. The quarter was ending. She'd only attended 4 of 10 classes. Her phone sat on my desk near her. Every 30 seconds or so, the screen lit up with a notification. She told me she was having trouble with all her classes. Her eyes teared up. She'd been given a new diagnosis, ADHD. In high school, they said depression and put me on medication. It was awful. I listened. She talked. As she did, her tears lessened. We agreed for her to see her advisor and the dean of students and to take it from there. I recommended she consult the Center for Students with Disabilities.
"Yeah, I guess I have a disability."
It wasn't my place to say otherwise. At our next appointment, Dr. R still didn't level a diagnosis. We changed my meds. We'd titrate off the antipsychotic, up the benzo, and keep the rest the same. The withdrawal symptoms came on fast. Weeks of agitation and nausea and a need to keep moving that reminded me of the akathisia, but less extreme. Nights in bed with my heart thumping in my ears, not able to sleep, feeling adrenaline rushes through my chest. The writing in my journal from that time doesn't seem like my own. The letters are lopsided, but not in a scribble. The slant and indentation are too severe, the result of my fingers pressing the pen hard against the page. The words grasp at positivity. I write the same thing over and over. I'm grateful for, and fill in the blank with anything I can come up with. I'm grateful for those flowers, that lamp, my legs, the color of my eyes. The dates of the entries are scattered, and I wonder what happened in between. Some days must have been so bad they consisted of calling my sister and her directing me through our emergency plan, benzo, CBT worksheet, sleep. Much the way medications had become meds, benzodiazepines had become benzos. Succumb to unconsciousness. Wake and wish the symptoms of withdrawal would be gone. The cold sweats, the vertigo, the shaking, the diarrhea. Worst of all was the inability to focus my gaze, even with my glasses on, and the sense that the ground was undulating beneath me. As I came off the antipsychotic and then the lithium, Dr. R was professional in the best sense of the word. He returned my calls the same day, always with an idea of what to do next. Sometimes it was like listening to a witch brew a potion, a dab of Benadryl, a dash of the benzo, a hint more of the antipsychotic. For now. The suicidality returned over Christmas break. Maybe it had to do with not teaching, not having anything to lift me out of it, even just for a few hours. One night I sat on the edge of my bed, the phone pressed to my ear. My plan was clear. Pills, a bottle of vodka, the tub. Through the phone came my sister's voice, not stern, but strong and commanding. She'd become my lifeline now that my mother was tending to her own emotional needs, and rightly so. My sister asked, "Did you already take it?" It meaning the benzo. "I don't want to," I said, tired of pills. My sister is one of those rare people who can handle anything. She seems to know what to say or whom to call or where to go. When she says to do something, she's almost always right. "Go take it." After I did and came back on the line, we went through the rest of my emergency plan. She walked me through a thought record, the CBT worksheet I held onto, which had me write down my thoughts and evaluate them, until the benzo knocked me out. She asked if I wanted her to wait until I fell asleep. "It's okay," I said. "Are you sure?" she asked. I nodded, a gesture she couldn't see. "Yes." After we hung up, I crawled into bed, fully clothed. 13. On solitude, and isolation, and loneliness, and brackets. Even by studio standards, my apartment was tiny, the kitchen too close to the bed practically touching the bookshelf and the desk. It had a slight view of the Chicago skyline, but mainly looked onto a brick wall. My immediate neighbors kept to themselves. They were presences, a series of doors opening and closing. The suicidality eventually went away, and the withdrawal symptoms stopped, only to be replaced by bone-deep anguish. I could barely be around people, even strangers on the street. By the time my meds were back to what they'd been with Dr. H, including the SSRI plus the benzo, I started to feel better, and then well. I had my mind back and could think clearly. I read a lot. I thought a lot. Not pathological rumination, contemplation, though maybe too much. The only topic I avoided, except when I had to see Dr. R, and even then, I never asked which diagnosis he saw in me, was mental illness. I existed like that for some time. In solitude. The ideal of solitude is strength. It's a skill to be mastered, the ability to be alone without feeling lonely. It's decidedly male, and often nationalistic, a symbol of American independence. It's Thoreau, who writes in Walden that he never felt lonesome or in the least oppressed by a sense of solitude, except once, for an hour, when he doubted if the near neighborhood of man was not essential to a serene and healthy life. Of course, he may have found the fancied advantages of human neighborhood insignificant because his solitary cabin was on land owned by Emerson, his close neighbor. Thoreau often went to the Emersons for dinner. He also entertained friends at his cabin and had his meals brought to him by his mother. That said, His Walden Pond experiment was less about living alone than living simply in nature. Solitude is righteous. It's Benjamin Rush, that controversial founding father who's often referred to as the father of American psychiatry. Rush is credited for having saved people with mental illnesses from being seen as having been possessed by demons, but also for subjecting them to bloodlettings and other gothic treatments. He considered solitude among the physical causes which influence the moral faculty for the better. It's a source of wisdom. It's the Buddha on the path to enlightenment, Jesus and Moses in the desert, Muhammad on the mountain. It's Thomas Merton abandoning the vacuous debaucheries of New York City for the Trappist Abbey of Gethsemane. As he writes in Thoughts in Solitude, when society is made of men who know no interior solitude, it can no longer be held together by love. And consequently, it is held together by a violent and abusive authority. For Merton, interior solitude is essential. I never thought of myself as a recluse. True, I fit the secondary meaning of the word, a person removed from society. But the primary definition is one who retreats for religious reasons, and I didn't follow a faith. Besides, recluse has an air of eccentricity about it. It's J.D. Salinger, number one on Time Magazine's top 10 most reclusive celebrities list, forsaking publishing and granting a single interview every 20 or 30 years. It's Howard Hughes, number two on the list, who holed himself up in the Beverly Hills Hotel and let his fingernails and toenails grow. Though, in all fairness, some speculate he may have suffered from a condition that made his nails both painful and difficult to clip. I wasn't a hermit, either, which has a stronger religious connotation. That time might best be described as urban solitude. I resided among people, passing them on the street, but never engaged. Not once did I dine out or go to the movies or to a museum. I taught, 12 hours a week, 30 weeks of the year, teaching at the same two universities, which, admittedly, offered a strong dose of social interaction. Teaching, mentoring, helping fulfilled me in a way nothing else did. Teaching gave me a dose of social interaction that could carry me for days. I worked out at a gym. I visited with my mother. But that was pretty much it. I saw no friends and rarely talked on the phone, even breaking off a friendship with someone dear to me who lived in another city and wanted to speak once a week to stay connected, because that much contact was unaccountably burdensome. I didn't have an agoraphobic aversion to going out. My dislike of crowded places was reasonable. Music festivals, parades, my nearby farmer's market where people gathered to buy overpriced organic blueberries and artisan pizzas and to participate in drum circles. True, I avoided stores. Still, I existed in the world. I just happened to spend most of that existence in a one-room apartment. I even had two weeks-long relationships, or month-long, though they were really a scattering of days. It's hard to call them relationships. Both men lived in other cities, so I didn't see them more than a handful of times. Both had been in my life years earlier as friends. Both were solitaries, too. One lived on a remote farm in Michigan, the other in Portland, Oregon. Both went about their lives much the way I went about mine, albeit in larger spaces. Both owned houses, no brick walls blocking their views. Most of our interactions happened by text, which gives a false sense of intimacy. Frequent texting, with its vibrating interruptions into what might be an otherwise dull day, makes us feel wanted and attracted. But solitaries, I realized too late, don't do well together. There was a prickliness to us. A certain distance had to be maintained. Both relationships ended fiercely and fast, as if each of us had reached our saturation points of closeness and had to retreat or risk losing the edges, those brackets that protected us. My solitary walks followed the same route, under the bridge, north along the lagoon, past the driving range, to the harbor and back. The park, which had once felt secluded, became downright desolate that winter. I didn't commune with the patches of nature portioned out to us in the city, barely noticing the red-winged blackbirds and the monarch butterflies, or that an entire row of trees had died as a result of a beetle infestation and been cut down. The repetition and orderliness of following the same path was like a companion. There and back. There and back. In terms of traditional companionship, I was still inside myself. Blocked off. Did my audiobooks count as companionship? No research has been done, but studies show that hearing loss increases feelings of loneliness. So it would follow that the sound of another's voice in our ears, the gift of Toni Morrison reading Beloved, or Gabriel Wolfe reading The Brothers Karamazov, must do something for us. Television and radio are considered companionship, though they're a slippery slope. According to researchers, watching a favorite show staves off loneliness, but a Netflix binge is a sign of it. Watching one episode functions as social surrogacy, but sitting on the couch for 10 hours to consume an entire season is a red flag. Radio, according to surveys conducted by media strategists and the BBC, can be a lifeline. I watched a bit of television, mostly Nordic noir, for Bredelsen and Borgen and Bron Brown, but didn't listen to the radio. And books. Research has shown that reading can contribute to feelings of connection and belonging, but nothing has been studied specifically in terms of loneliness or isolation. My reading selections were odd. I read all of Patricia Highsmith's work. Highsmith was also a solitary who spent most of her life among snails and cats, both of which she apparently adored. She was a misanthrope and an alcoholic. In her stories and novels, she favors degenerate, predatory protagonists who cheat and steal and lie and murder, and whom we end up rooting for. I reread Strangers on a Train so many times I lost count. It's fitting that I would immerse myself in a book about a seemingly fleeting human interaction so potent and dangerous that it gives one character enough power over the other to convince him to commit murder. Social media didn't affect me very much. My followers on Twitter were barely in the double digits. I had hundreds and hundreds of friends on Facebook whom I didn't know, even by name. I didn't have an Instagram account. How many arty abstract photos of my brick wall could I post? Many blame social media for America's collective loneliness, but studies don't support that view. One study found that only negative experiences on social media contribute to loneliness. Another reported social media can contribute to feelings of isolation, but couldn't state definitively which came first, the isolation or social media. On the Cigna U.S. Loneliness Index, people who consistently used social media scored 44%, whereas people who never used it scored 42%. It was a draw. In a Pew Research Center report, 81% of teens reported that social media enhances their friendships, and 68% said they felt more supported by their friends because of it. In combating loneliness, the Cigna study shows that social media is less a factor than the quality of our interactions. Simply having people in our lives does little to assuage loneliness. 1 in 4 Americans feels misunderstood. 2 in 5 don't think their relationships are meaningful, and only half report having meaningful interactions daily. Many people, scientists, psychologists, journalists, bloggers, distinguish between solitude and isolation. The binary is simplistic. Solitude, good. Isolation, bad. By definition, solitude and isolation are more nuanced than the good-bad binary makes them out to be. Solitude isn't all purity and fortitude. By definition, it's merely the quality or state of being alone or remote from society, and can be a lonely place. Isolation isn't necessarily punitive. The verb to isolate denotes the voluntary act of separating from others. It's benign, even positive, occurring alone or once. Yet isolation is seen as a punishment, thrust upon us and never entered into by choice. The word connotes solitary confinement and incarceration, two tactics rooted in prejudice. The common remark that someone with a peaceful mind can enjoy isolation as monkish solitude, whereas someone with a troubled mind will suffer solitude as imprisonment, misses the fact that a monk typically isn't in a 48-square-foot cell, could not possibly have been arrested as a result of racial profiling, and is free to leave at any time. I could leave, but never went far. No vacation, no quick road trip out of the city. I rarely went outside a 5-mile radius. Same bed, same breakfast, lunch, and dinner table. Same desk, same walls. My apartment stopped suiting me. It wasn't a refuge anymore. No relief came at being alone each time I walked through the door. That small space no longer provided solitude. Solitude slid into isolation, and isolation tipped over into loneliness. I blamed the claustrophobic lack of square footage, the oppressive brick wall. Even before I walked in the door, I felt a crushing weight. The essayist Michel de Montaigne would have disagreed. Physical space doesn't determine our emotions, the mind does. Our disease lies in the mind, which cannot escape from itself. Montaigne would have told me to keep a back shop, a private room within the self where others can't enter. Plaster and wood have nothing to do with it. We must have a mind pliable in itself that will be company. Finding contentment in solitude requires self-reliance. But my inner back shop had transformed from a citadel of solitude to a penitentiary of isolation and loneliness. Like the solitude good, isolation bad calculation, a similar binary is applied to solitude and loneliness. Except loneliness isn't just bad, it's dangerous. In the US, it's an epidemic that affects teenagers and the elderly most acutely. It's a health threat on par with smoking, contributing to heart disease and increasing the risk of stroke, type 2 diabetes, dementia, and suicide. Loneliness affects how we work, making us less likely to succeed and take pleasure in what we do. But loneliness isn't threatening. It means being without company. Only the tertiary and quaternary definitions emotionalize it as sad from being alone and producing a feeling of bleakness or desolation. Loneliness, like any difficult emotion, gets its power from the conviction that we're the only ones feeling it. As a defense, we reassure ourselves that others feel it too. We join loneliness meetup groups and form people haters clubs. Thousands of us like the book cited on the loneliness quotes page on Goodreads. 11,000 people liked a passage from Jodi Picoult's bestseller, My Sister's Keeper. Let me tell you this. If you meet a loner, no matter what they tell you, it's not because they enjoy solitude. It's because they have tried to blend into the world before, and people continue to disappoint them. The loner, the lonely one, isn't to blame. It's other people. Discomfort is by nature uncomfortable. Days spent in my apartment were jarring. Even my solitary walks became unnerving. But I didn't call my discomfort symptoms. The change didn't come as a chrysalis moment, not an instant of blossoming. It came as a slow unraveling, facilitated in part by a book. I entered my pathological life through one book, The Best Little Girl in the World, and exited it through another, the DSM. It's unclear why I suddenly wanted to know the source of my diagnosis. Maybe it was the solitude or the discomfort. My doctoral program taught me to rely on primary sources. I hadn't been doing that. I wish I could say my first real encounter with the DSM took place in the dim, dusty stacks of a medical library, but I was in my tiny apartment in the blue light of my computer screen. My desk lamp was lit. A half-nibbled square of chocolate sat on a paper towel beside my keyboard. An internet window was open to the library portal of the university where I taught. I typed DSM in the search box and filtered for online access. Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM-5. American Psychiatric Association, DSM-5 Task Force. Copyright 2013. I clicked and scrolled past the purple cover to the introduction. The sense that if I kept reading, it might contaminate me, and I might somehow fall back into that world of diagnoses and Dr. M's and PHP's almost made me stop. But I clicked on the Bipolar and Related Disorders chapter. It was all there. Short paragraphs describing each disorder, followed by numbered and alphabetical symptoms lists, followed by codes and specifiers and diagnostic features. People complain that these lists and categories are what's wrong with the DSM. But to me, they were beautiful, clear, orderly. Then I found other books warning against accepting DSM diagnoses. In Saving Normal, An Insider's Revolt Against Out-of-Control Psychiatric Diagnosis, DSM-5, Big Pharma, and the Medicalization of Ordinary Life, Alan Francis writes, "New diagnoses in psychiatry are potentially much more dangerous than new drugs because they can lead to massive overtreatment with all the possible side effects. In The Loss of Sadness, How Psychiatry Transformed Normal Sorrow into Depressive Disorder by Alan Horowitz and Jerome Wakefield, they state, pathologization of normal conditions may cause harm, and avoidance of such pathologization may decrease such harm. I read Edward Shorter's A History of Psychiatry and How Everyone Became Depressed, The Rise and Fall of the Nervous Breakdown, and Hannah Decker's The Making of DSM-3, A Diagnostic Manual's Conquest of American Psychiatry, and Anne Harrington's Mind Fixers, Psychiatry's Troubled Search for the Biology of Mental Illness, and Thomas Saz, and Robert Whittaker, and Irving Goffman, and The Book of Woe, in which Gary Greenberg eviscerates the DSM. He asks psychiatry for one, just one slam dunk diagnosis. The psychiatric equivalent of strep or diabetes, a single diagnosis that indicated a single pathology and a single treatment. But I would have settled for less. One solid example of the value of a diagnostic system. Spoiler, he never finds one. The truth was everywhere but nowhere. Most people I knew still believed in the chemical imbalance theory. They talked about their depression and anxiety disorder as actual illnesses and took medication and saw psychiatrists and psychologists and therapists, though how many would if they didn't have insurance and had to pay out of pocket? All without knowing what the acronym DSM even stood for. The truth was in plain sight, but hidden, bracketed. Another chrysalis moment came in late January, a kind of cracking, different, outer shell cracking. The wind whistled through the unsealed gaps in my windows. I woke and pulled up the shades to find them covered in frost, making it hard to see outside. I couldn't even glimpse the brick wall. The weather app showed a feels-like temperature of negative 40 degrees Fahrenheit. A Google search revealed that a public health advisory had been issued, warning people to stay inside. Schools and businesses were closed. Before the change, this would have been just another day in my apartment. I ate breakfast, wrote for a while, and graded papers. I'd finished washing my spoon and cereal bowl when my skin started to itch. I scratched my forearms, inciting the itch. Soon my skin was red and puffy. I put Cordate on it, and the itching dissipated a bit. Back at my desk, sitting at the computer, the shades drawn to keep out the cold, my dark felt oppressively small. The walls didn't close in, but I became increasingly aware of their closeness. I tugged at my turtleneck. My mouth went dry. I couldn't swallow. My only thought was, out. None of my neighbors were in the hallway. No one joined me in the elevator. The lobby, too, was vacant. I stood at the glass door entrance of my building, which wasn't covered in frost, and peered out at what might have been a portrait of extinction. No cars passed on the street, no pedestrians on the sidewalk. Whereas once being cut off wouldn't have fazed me, a wave of isolation and loneliness crashed over me. I saw in my reflection a woman very much alone, but ready to reach out. That force, that reaching, was more powerful than the one that had pulled me into myself. It propelled me out. The propelling wasn't pleasant. My whole default mode ruptured. I felt exposed, my brick walls and frosted windows demolished. My life was no longer bracketed in the same way. The next morning, I called my sister. Her voice had the measured tone of someone ready for a crisis. No crisis, I said, and asked if I could work at her house that day. She set me up in their living room on their L-shaped couch, and there I stayed and worked as they went about their lives. My nephew leaving for tennis practice, my brother-in-law coming home from work, my niece down in the basement, under the stairs in a kind of fort she built, a spot she loved, doing her homework, my sister caring for all of us. My niece and nephew, who were too young to be told what was happening, never questioned why I was over so much. Their ordinary hellos were a balm. My brother-in-law, too, wore a facial expression that always seemed to say, "Here if you need me." With one call, I could invoke the kind of social support few have. In my IOPs, during group therapy sessions, more often than not, someone spoke about how their families didn't understand. As we sat in a circle and listened to each other, one woman, tears in her eyes, her legs crossed, her long dark hair falling in front of her face, said that her sister, having found out about her diagnosis, would no longer let her babysit her niece. I always knew my sister, my mother, my father, my stepmother, my brother-in-law, my niece and nephew, were there for me. Over the next few months, I settled into new patterns. A reasonable part of my day was spent in the company of others, family, acquaintances, colleagues, strangers. I didn't just notice people. I took note of them. The cashier at the grocery store, the person behind me in line, the Uber driver, the couple at a nearby table. Each day, upon returning to my building, I rode the elevator and stood in silence with my neighbors. Most of them stared down at their phones. When we reached my floor, I wished them a good evening, smiled, and tried to make eye contact with at least one person. Some responded with surprise, others like I'd startled them. One guy furrowed his brow with annoyance, almost offense, as if I'd invaded his personal space, or solitude, or isolation, or loneliness, as if I'd trespassed his brackets. Some made eye contact and wished me the same. Others responded with a mechanical, "You too," without glancing up from their phones. At first, their responses mattered. But I realized that wasn't the point. The key to connection was not to be needy of connection with others. We have to give freely of ourselves, act as social philanthropists who donate anonymously, expecting no plaques or appreciation in return. It didn't take meaningful interactions to infiltrate my isolation, curb my loneliness, and spur my recovery. Noticing other people was enough. My "have a good evening" and "have a good one" communications provided meaningful interaction. What constitutes meaningful interaction? What degree of intimacy does it require? What emotions do we need?